You're listening to Radio Golf Show. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, my oh my, are you in for a treat? Tonight, we bring you Mr. Jay Stapley, guitarist, writer, producer, studio owner, educator, an artist, and a sportsman. He worked alongside Roger Waters and Mike Oldfield and recorded and toured with German megastar Marius Müller-Westernhagen for 25 years, becoming his co-producer and his musical director. He's currently on hiatus from a tour with Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, which will continue in the spring with, among others, six shows in Germany for the German crowd, March 8th in Hamburg, March 10th and 11th in Essen, March 12th in Frankfurt, geez, that's four nights in a row, March 24th in Berlin, and April 4th in Leipzig. Jay, we've been talking about you coming on the show for quite a while, and I'm happy that it has finally worked out, and really looking forward to this. A very warm welcome to you. It's good to see you again, sir.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for inviting me. It's nice to see you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Jay, you were born in April 57 in Cuckfield, Sussex.
That's correct.
Yeah. About 35 miles south of London.
Yeah.
What's your earliest childhood memory?
The severe winter of 1963, snow.
Okay.
Heavy snow, which, you know, in England, if one flake of snow falls, all of the transport system comes to a halt.
Uh-huh.
Or the trains stop running, the buses stop running, nobody drives, the country just comes to a halt.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I'm used to touring in Germany in the winter where you just put your snow tires on and off you go. You know, it's not a problem.
There you go.
But for us, it's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. In England, that would be a big deal. Do you recall the moment you discovered your passion for music and for playing music?
My parents were both musical. My father was an extraordinarily good pianist, and my mother was a singer. Mm-hmm. And I remember musical soirees in the house when friends of theirs who were also players would come and join in. And my father discovered pop music in the 60s. He started listening to pirate radio, and he heard piano players like Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, and he started to play boogie woogie piano, but with the fearsome technique of a very well-trained classical pianist. I don't know, you might have to translate this, but one of the things he used to do as an exercise was put a book of Chopin etudes on the piano and sight read them, transposing the left hand down a semitone and the right hand up a tone as he read them. I mean, it sounded awful, but it was an extraordinary mental and physical achievement. So he started playing boogie woogie piano with all the technique and harmonic invention of his classical training.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful thing to hear.
Was the guitar the first instrument you learned?
Yeah, but what happened was he used to teach teachers to teach at a teacher training college, and he taught music and theology. And as pop music became more popular, he wanted to be able to teach his students the guitar. So he persuaded the college to buy a couple of cheap Spanish guitars. Excuse me. And I'd never attempted to play the piano because the possibility of ever getting any even close to his standard of playing was just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I regret it now. I wish I could play the piano. But then I picked up the guitar. I brought these guitars home with a like a chord book, with songs like the Red River Valley and stuff. And I picked up this guitar and I played a G chord and I went, yeah, okay, I can do this. And just started learning, and within a matter of weeks was way ahead of where he was at with it.
Right. How old were you then?
About 11.
11. Okay. And then how soon after that did you figure out or discover that you could turn this passion into a job?
Well, the first thing that happened was that one day in the supermarket in the sleepy little village in Kent where I grew up, I heard the intro to Honky Tonk Women. And I thought, I want to make that noise. So my mother, bless her, saved up some money and bought me a very cheap electric guitar and an amplifier. And I joined a band at school and got on really well and really enjoyed it. And I remember when I was about 15 or so, I was at the point where I had to start thinking about going to what I was going to do. My school wanted me to go to university to do languages. But I thought, you know what? I'd really like to be a musician, to play the guitar for a living. And it's quite important. It's always been important to me to make the distinction. I did not want to become a star. I did not want to become an artist. I wanted to be a working guitar player.
So that was your aspiration to
That
become
was my aspiration. And I
a
thought,
session musician.
yeah, I thought, well, I didn't know what a session musician was at the time. I just wanted to be a working guitar player. And I thought, okay, so if I go to university and then get a job and get to the age of 30, which at the time seemed awfully old, I'll think I never even tried. Whereas if I try to be a musician now and I fail, I can always go to university later. So I left school, much to the disgust of my school, who wanted me, as I say, to go to university and blah, blah, blah. I left school and I had a place at a local university to study sound engineering. But a job came up in a guitar shop in a local town. And I went for that instead. And I think my parents, who were getting divorced at the time, didn't really have their eye on the ball in terms of their middle son's life development. So they just said, yeah, whatever, whatever, whatever. Sorry, we're busy. Not in those words, but So I got myself a little one room flat in the town where this guitar shop was. And I went and lived there and I worked in the record shop. The same family owned a record shop and a guitar shop. And I worked in the record shop, which meant I could just listen to anything I wanted to and get, I would devour records. And then the job came up in the guitar shop. So I moved there and I'd started playing with local, mostly folk artists, doing gigs with them. And then I used to play with a woman and her husband who ran a country and western club in a nearby town. And every fortnight I would play with them as a support act to the travelling bands that used to come through. And one of the travelling bands that came through had lost or fallen out with their guitar player. And they offered me the job on the strength of having seen me play with this woman. And by the age of 18, I was a professional musician. I was working, we were playing 7 nights a week.
Right.
I was a professional musician, which so it took
As
me what?
musicians, I'm sure your parents were supportive of your career choice, or did they want you to go to university as well?
No, they said, if that's what you want to do, you're obviously good. I used to play with my father used to do, he used to conduct school orchestras in productions of Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and such like. And I used to play guitar in the
Right.
productions.
Cool.
So, they said, you're obviously good at it. Good luck.
You go. What was the first record you bought?
I bought For myself, it was Bridge Over Troubled Water, the album Bridge Over Troubled Water. An uncle of mine had bought me a Gene Autry album before that. But yeah, Bridge Over Troubled Water was my first.
Unbelievable. I read somewhere that you're a Spurs fan.
I am. I'm not a tribal football fan. I'm not a very good football fan. When I moved to London in the late 70s and the early 80s, Spurs were my local club, and Chris Waddle and Glenn Hoddle were playing for them at the time. And I found it much more artistic and creative than the kind of animalistic football that has been the trademark and the great sadness of English football, frankly.
Well, when I started watching the Premier League, I was a Spurs fan too, mainly because of Glenn Hoddle. Well, actually, mainly because of Glenn Hoddle's hair, but I know what you're talking about. He was some player. I mentioned you returning to the upcoming tour. You just, I guess, finished the first leg, you can call it whatever. Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells. Are you nervous before a show, before you go on stage?
No.
No.
I've been doing this for half a century, and I was playing live gigs 7 nights a week from the age of about 18 to the age till my mid-30s, actually. I used to get home from tour with Roger Waters and phone round all my mates who played the Irish circuit in London and say, "I'm home, got any gigs?"
Wow.
So no, I'm not. I mean, it sounds arrogant, but the answer I normally give, people ask me that. I ask, what do they do for a living? They say, "Oh, well, I'm in insurance." And I go, "Well, do you get nervous when you go to the office?"
I
No,
guess.
I know how to do it. I know how to do it.
And preparation, and we'll talk about preparation and knowing what you have to do. We here, we pretty much prepare for none of these episodes. We check facts we're not sure of that support our opinion and maybe discover some new ones. And I believe this gives us that it gives the conversations more spontaneity,
Sure.
which I find more interesting. And that's kind of what I was going for with the preparation, but we'll talk about that. And slowly we will work our way towards the advertised and planned topic of arts and sports. The phrase "don't try to make it happen, let it happen," I think fits that perfectly. And let's start with a preparation and letting go when it comes to art and music. In your on your blog, you wrote this fascinating piece called "Please Don't Try Harder." I don't have your blog web address in front of me, but in this blog, you write you start off and you say, "Believe it or not, trying harder is the worst thing you can do." Can you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yes, I can. I'm not quite sure how to get into it, but basically,
Maybe as an educator.
there's something similar to there's a similar thing in both sports and music. All sports people, all musicians talk about being in the zone. The best way to break that state of being in the zone is to try hard. And the second best way to break it is to think, "Oh, I'm really in the zone now. Oh, I'm playing really well." Or, every putt is going in and every drive is going exactly where I place it. Or, every time I hit a topspin forehand volley, it's hitting the line. And that zone is a strange and wonderful place, and it's a kind of mixture of not giving a damn, It's like, to me, it's kind of close. I've never been able to surf, but I imagine it's kind of similar to surfing in that the trick is to balance on the crest of the perfect wave. And the trick then is not to fall off. And most musicians, and I'm sure sportsmen have the same, they call it the yips, I believe, in golf, don't they? Have this thing where for the whole of the game leading up to it, you've been in the zone. Every shot's been perfect. And then, if you're a tennis player, for example, on match point, after five sets of hitting the lines and every shot has been perfect, on match point, you put it out because you're aware of the value of this point and your perception. Up till then, you've not really been. I really do see it. Maybe it's just the way that I've dealt with it, but I'd see it as not really caring. You don't, if you care too much, you invest huge amounts of ego and self-worth in it. And when you fall off, you're going to be disappointed. If you know how to do this, you can trust your mind and body to do it without interfering with them. You know exactly how to hit the perfect drive. But as soon as you say, right, I'm going to hit the perfect drive, you've pretty much guaranteed that you're not going to be able to, that you're not going to hit the perfect drive, because there's a level of you that is not being, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? Your intent is not pure. Your intent has become corrupt, if you like. And I used something. One of the big differences between music and sport for me is that sport is all about notions like striving. I'm going to strive. I'm going to maximize my potential. Music is about humility and cooperation, the very opposite of striving. And I said in the blog, I've shared the stage on a few occasions with musicians who strive, and their mental noise pollutes the atmosphere, making it impossible to play with them. And that's a massive difference between sport and music. We both share the notion of the zone. But the way that we arrive at it and remain in it.
Well, arriving at it, I think it's very, very difficult because you never really know when you're going to be in it, and you're right about that as well. You never know beforehand whether a show is going to be extraordinary. But I think the first thing you need to do that is you have to have a level of physical skills that you master in order to even think about the zone.
I mean, tennis is the prime example. It is impossible to play tennis in any meaningful way without a basic level of technique. And most musical instruments are the same. The trouble is, people get caught up in technique and they pursue technique for technique's sake. As a musician, technique for me means the ability to express myself on my instrument without having to think about the physical process of how I'm going to do it. And you talk about not knowing whether the show's going to be any good or not. Every night when you step on stage, you throw yourself off a cliff, if you're being honest. You don't know if the show's going to be good, because one of the things you learn as a performer is that you cannot make it happen. It is given to you, or if it is, or it isn't. Therefore, you have to develop a fallback structure so that if the gift of inspiration is not given to you that night, you've got a structure that you can play that you know will get you through the night. And you soon learn that more times than not, it happens, and you inspire, and it comes through you.
What role does the energy with the audience play in that for you?
A massive role, though you've got to be really careful. I learned when I started doing football stadium shows with Marius, the wave of energy that hits you when you go on stage. If you go with it, you'll only last 10 minutes and then you'll be shattered. So you have to go, hey, it's all right, it's all right, it's all right, calm down, calm down. And you do your thing and then you let it build, after the first 20 minutes has gone by. But I mean, I've just come off, had this experience of touring. We had quite a brutal schedule on the UK tour that we've just been doing. And there were nights when I sat at the other side of the stage, ready to go on, yawning, feeling like I wanted to go to sleep. But by the end of the night, when you've had the love of 2 or 3,000 people thrown at you, you feel enervated, and suddenly I'm full of energy and I'm buzzing, and feeling that happen in the room throughout the course of the gig is one of the great joys of what I do.
Even when
That's
you're
why I
yawning
keep.
before you go on.
Yeah, even though I'm yawning before I
Yeah.
go on, I'm ready for bed. I'm 67 years old.
Well, longevity is another thing we'll talk about. But you just mentioned stadium shows, and but and you've played in the most prestigious venues in the world, and festivals, and all kinds of stuff, stadiums, football stadiums. Do you have a favorite room that you've played?
Probably the Westfalenhalle,
Huh.
which sounds horrible for drums and
Absolutely.
sounds fabulous for guitars.
Oh. Wow.
But I think one of my favorite venues that I ever played in, when I was a kid, I used to get home from school and I would plug in my guitar and I would play along with any or sometimes all of Sticky Fingers album, the Layla double album, and Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, the live album by the Stones that was recorded at Madison Square Gardens. And in 1987, I stepped onto the stage of Madison Square Gardens, this place that I'd had, in my vision since I was 12. I stepped onto the stage at Madison Square Gardens with Roger Waters, and a tear came into my eye. But yeah, there were, I mean, venue, the problem with most music venues is they are not designed for amplified music. They are designed, the theatres particularly and concert halls are designed to enable somebody who is sitting in the highest row at the furthest part of the back of the room to hear a whisper on stage. And as soon as you put a drum kit onto that stage, you're fighting a losing battle straight away. The one exception, the notable exception, is the Sapp Arena in Mannheim, which when they built it, they knew that they were going to be a lot of their income was going to come from music. So they hired some acousticians to be involved in the design and the construction. And that sounds great for those, we call them sheds, the sort of 15, 20,000 seater hockey arenas. They normally sound disgusting because they're so echoey. You hit a drum and it bounces back off the ceiling and it bounces back off all of the walls, and they all take different times to get back to you. So one drum hit turns into a dozen drum hits. But that hall sounds lovely.
But now with this on this tour, you've played smaller venues, like you said, 2, 3,000 people, theaters, old
Yeah.
theaters that you might remember the names from an album that was recorded there or something like that, or you've
I
seen.
remember them from reading the gig lists in the Melody Maker and the New Musical Express, which were the pop music magazines when I was a teenager. And I've been playing all these halls, the De Montfort Hall, Leicester, places that I've seen on gig lists since I was a teenager. And this is going to sound terribly arrogant, Frank, but that's because I am terribly arrogant. I'd missed out on that whole circuit because I went straight from pubs and clubs to arenas and stadiums, and I never played these theatres. Most musicians of my generation would have played them in their 20s and early 30s. I never played them. So for me to go and play in these places has been delightful.
Yeah, that's yeah, you are really are arrogant. I mean, at this point,
Thank you.
maybe at this point, maybe we should tell people that the last time we were hanging out, the next day you put diesel into your regular petrol trailer, is that correct?
I had a camper van. I
A
was
camper van, yeah.
going around Germany. I had a camper van. I had a petrol Ford Transit. No, it was a diesel Transit.
And you put regular in it.
And I went to an Aral garage in Aral petrol station, somewhere near Bremerhaven. And the tank, the pumps weren't marked. Normally it says, gas oil or benzene or whatever. And for some reason they weren't marked. I guess they must have been color coded. And I filled up my diesel Transit with petrol, with unleaded petrol.
So it was the unmarked petrol thing there, not the night before.
Yeah, not the night
Yeah,
before, no.
definitely not.
I haven't used an Aral filling station since.
There you go. Let's go back a little bit to the session musician. And you said you didn't even know what that was when you started out. These session musicians, when I think about it, and when I thought about it leading up to this conversation, they're much more highly skilled than usually members of a band,
Yes,
right?
absolutely. Absolutely. People, if you look at bands like Guns N' Roses, even Pink Floyd, the musicians in those bands would not survive a week as a session musician because they just do what they do. And part of the art of forming a band is you find a group of people whose thing, whatever it is they do, fits together. The art of a session musician is to be able to walk into any musical ensemble and fit into it. No matter what's going on around you, you are able to fit into it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember buying albums and of people I didn't know, and I would see, whoa, Steve Gadd is playing drums on this. This has got to be good, you know, or Steve Lukather, or you know, whoever the famous session musicians were. How do you go about preparing to play? Because when you come in to do a tour with somebody, obviously you need to know their songs from beginning to end.
No, you need to know the songs that you're playing on the tour from beginning to end.
Okay, big difference.
This is a big thing that you have to deal with a lot. I've been doing all this Tubular Bells stuff because I played with Mike Oldfield in 1992, and you have really difficult conversations with fans who assume that you must be a big fan of Mike Oldfield because you've played with him. And I have to say, no. I like what he does. I admire it. But what I do as a session musician is when I get hired to play somebody's music, for the time that I'm playing that music, I love it. No, more accurately, I believe in it. I believe it. I have to believe it because that's my job. My job is to add my emotional energy to their music. And that's the reality of what I do. It's got nothing to do with moving my fingers about on a bit of wood and metal. It has everything to do with the fact that by a process that I still don't understand after half a century of doing it, I am able to inspire emotions and feelings in people by playing the guitar. And I still don't understand how I do it, but I know that I can. And so I'm hired to do this thing because I can transmit emotion through my playing. So in order to do that, I have to believe in what I'm doing. But at the end of the job, I'll walk away and I may not listen to that artist ever again.
What freedom do you have for a live show of interpreting these songs that somebody else has written that's standing next to you on stage?
That depends on who you're working
Yeah, I
with.
would imagine.
With Roger Waters, the first thing he said to me is, don't copy Dave Gilmour's solos. You don't have to play his solos. You're here because you play in a similar style. So you just play your solos. So I would do, for example, on Another Brick in the Wall, I would play the first phrase of it. I go, do-do-do-do-do-do, and then I'd go my own way. But I'd just play that phrase. The Tubular Bells 50th anniversary shows we're doing at the moment, I'm given a lot of freedom by the arranger and musical director, because what he did was he kind of reimagined Tubular Bells. And I play, there are things that are structural and architectural, if I can put it that way, that I have to play. But I was really, the first time we did this show was at the Festival Hall in London in 2021. And I did loads of research leading up to it because I'd played Tubular Bells several times with other acts. And I was delighted to discover that Mike never played it the same way twice. He would improvise and he would play harmonies to the lines, or he would give a theme that on the record is on the flute. He'd give that to another guitar or something. He would, and there are passages where I have complete freedom to improvise.
Okay. How was it with Marius? Maybe different
Marius never once, in 25 years, I cannot remember Marius ever telling me what to play.
Is that maybe also because you played on some of the recordings as well?
Yes, but even on
Okay.
the recordings, you know that you've got the right musician in the studio when you don't have to tell them what to play. And he was very good at picking people, because what happens is, some artists are really precious about it. You know, there's stories about Mike Oldfield. He would hire a guitar player to come and do some stuff, and when the guitar player had left the studio, he would send his guy out to buy the same equipment, and he would replace the part. He would copy the part the guy had played and replace it. Some artists are really precious, but the good artists, you learn that good musicians, they bring something else to your music. It's almost like, here's my music standing on the table, right? I see it from this angle only. Another musician comes in and they shine a light on it from another angle, and I look at it, I go, oh, I'd never realized that about my music before. And the good artists let you be yourself. They might filter it sometimes, they might edit it sometimes, but basically they surround themselves with people who play the right thing.
How did your and I know your how much you enjoy Germany,
Yes.
not only for the Nürburgring, we'll talk about that too. How did you end up here with Marius and 25 years working with him? I mean, that must have been in the 80s, no? Or the 90s?
In the early 80s, I was in a band with a guy called Julian Dawson, who was known in Germany as the Glatzkopf because he was bald.
Glatzkopf.
We toured Germany in a van that was even smaller than a transit van. We used to come and play the little rock clubs. And he was doing a record, and it was being recorded at the Cannes studio in Weilerswist, the Inner Space studio, which is now in a museum in Gronau. And the producer, a guy called René Tinner, used to. He liked what I did, and he used to hire me to go over and play guitar on people's records. You know, he'd have an artist in the studio and they needed guitar, and he would hire me to go over. So I would fly over to Cologne for a week, do all the guitars on the record, come back home. And one year, it was 1985, I think, he called me and said, I've got this German artist here, he's not happy with the guitars on his new record that I'm producing. You know, can you come over? And that was Marius. That was the album that was called Westernhagen, that had, oh God, Narbenherz,
Yeah,
Bad.
Narbenherz, but yeah, I know this album.
Yeah,
So.
Weihnachtliches Liebe was on it, I think. And I came over and bang, 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 did the record in, I don't know, 3 days or something. And got on very well with Marius, liked him, we got on well. He asked me to go on tour with him, but I was just going off with Roger Waters to the States again. But when I got back from Roger Waters in America in 1987, he called me again and we went on tour. And from that day, when he worked, I worked until whatever it was, 2005 probably.
Right. Yeah, I think he just finished a tour now, and again, I don't know who's in his band, but certainly a legend in Germany, one of the first German rock stars there was.
For sure.
The cultural impact, I mean, now it's like a Rolling Stones show. I mean, you see people in the audience that are 75, you see kids that are 20, or even younger.
I after my relationship, my professional relationship with Marius ended, I kept getting a phone emails from this guy that does a Vestenhagen tribute thing, saying, "Will you come and do a couple of gigs?" And I went, "No, it's not dignified. No, I won't." And then I got talking to a friend of mine who was one of the keyboard players in Dire Straits, and he said,
Alan Clark.
"Yes."
Oh.
So Alan said, I wasn't going to drop the name, Frank. I was trying to be tactful for once. So Alan said, he said, I get the same with Dire Straits bands. And he said, in the end, I thought, you know what? I spent 25 years helping build that brand. Why should I not be able to earn from it just because the singer doesn't want to do it anymore? And I went, yeah, okay. So the next time this guy emailed me, I said, yeah, all right then. And I went and did a gig with him, and I could see in front of us there were lots of the old, what the crew used to call the Schlachtbummler, the old fans, from the 80s. And I could see how much the songs meant to them. And it brought a tear to my eye, and I was proud to feel that I was a part of it. And the songs are part of modern German culture.
And I think you're not the only guy who played with Marius that's playing with the tribute band. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
There's other guys too, right?
Well, we have to earn a we have to earn our living somehow.
But I'm sure you get some royalties from Spotify,
No, because I didn't write any of the material.
And as a session musician, you don't
As
then.
a session musician, I get royalties from TV and radio. Every time the song that I played on, a record that I played on, gets played. I'll tell you a brief story, if I
Please.
may, about that. So in 2018, my wife and I went to Canada for a month's holiday. And I was sitting on the aeroplane at Heathrow, about to turn my phone off, when my Facebook feed lit up with posts from other musicians saying, "Have you seen your PPL?" And PPL in the UK is the equivalent of the GVL in Germany. And basically, that's an agency. Every time a record is played on the radio or TV, it's registered, and the GVL collect the money that's due to the musicians and send it to the musicians. So I thought, oh, the PPL must have made a mistake. And I looked at my bank account and went, what? And realized that instead of driving over the Rocky Mountains in a Toyota Yaris, I was going to be able to hire a much nicer car, because several thousand pounds had come into my bank account from the PPL. And what had happened was the PPL had finally, after 20 years of trying, concluded an agreement with the GVL to collect money from for English musicians who had played on German records.
Wow.
And 25 years of hits, number one hits with Marius, came in one lump.
Thankfully, before the vacation, not after. You could enjoy
Yes. Well,
it.
no, it would have been equally welcome after, because I would have been so far in debt. I would have been overdrawn heavily.
There you go. One of the things about session musicians that I also find interesting, they're very particular about their gear. I always see you with that Strat. How many guitars do you take on the road?
That depends. If I'm touring at the level I used to tour at with Marius, I would take two, and the crew would bring about another 50 that I could pick whatever I wanted out of. Now, with the Tubular Bells show, I take my Strat and I take a PRS, because that gives me the sounds that Mike used to use. But my Strat, which is right here beside me,
There you
friends,
go. I see it with the black fretboard. It's beautiful.
that's been my chosen weapon since 1986.
There you go.
And that it becomes part of your body. I know without having to think about it how that instrument will sound if I touch it in a certain way.
And it's an
And
extension.
it's part of your body.
Like a tennis racket or a golf club for
Exactly.
the top golfers, you know.
Yeah, there are limits to how particular I am about my gear, though, because when you play these big, echoey old places, you realize that the only person that cares about the really expensive reverb pedal that you've bought is you. Nobody else cares. Because you can't hear the detail. I learned that with Roger. He used to say, you play these arenas, there's no point in playing fast. It just because they echo so much, it just becomes a blur. He said, what works in these rooms is long bent notes, and they just sing around the room, which is why I love the Westfalenhalle. Because you play long bent notes and it makes the room ring really nicely.
Longevity. I mean, the guys you keep mentioning, whether it's Marius, who's 75, and I don't know how old Roger Waters is. He's got to be up there as well. Right? He's got to be probably older than 75. Brian Ferry. I mean, these guys, Mick Jagger. I mean, I don't know if Jagger has sung better, than he's doing now. I mean, that's why they're still doing it. What gives those artists the longevity? Is it the material?
I think a large part of it, certainly in the case of someone like Roger, he believes A, that he's got something to say, and B, that he's got the right to say it. And he's compelled to do it. They don't do it for the money. Mike Oldfield was the same. They really don't do it for the money. They don't even do it for the audience. They do it because they are driven to do it. And I'm enough of an old hippie to believe that going on stage and having people throw their love at you is good for you. You know, it's good for you mentally, and what's good for you mentally is good for you physically.
And that frees you up to get into the zone, which again gets a response from the audience and snowballs into an amazing show. I guess it's maybe like an athlete, whether it's a football team, it's a team sport or a tennis or golf, whatever. Once you get into the zone and start hitting amazing shots or doing whatever they do, the audience gets into it, the crowd gets into it, and that they again feed off of that, like you would in a concert.
Yeah, because we are all humans. We all feed off approval and love and positive energy. I believe that most performing artists, whether it be musicians or actors or whatever, do what they do initially. At the beginning of their lives, it's about, look at me, mum. No, mum, look at me. No, not him, not him. Look at me, mum, me. And then as you grow up, your motivation changes. But that's the starting point.
There you go. John Daly, two-time major winner character, once said, I played some of my best golf drunk. As a rock and roll musician, surely you've been on stage with people who have played drunk and have played amazing, and the next day they have no recollection of what happened.
Okay, we come back to the difference between the world of the session musician and the band like Guns N' Roses or whatever. As a session musician, rule one is if you're wired, you're fired. And I would not dare go on stage drunk because I know I would be fired. I'll tell you what, there is, however, some relevance in what John Daly said. I mentioned in my blog that some of the best gigs I've ever done have been when I'm so tired that before the show I've thought, oh God, it's going to be terrible. I'm not going to be able to play tonight. And because you're so tired or drunk, you get out of the way of it. You don't try and control it, and it flows through you. And for me, I play my best when I play my best, I'm not doing it. I'm just a tool in its hands. I'm a Werkzeug, and it comes through me. And I suspect it's probably the same for top-level sports. I think it was Boris Becker who first said, or the first person I heard say, that 99% of top-level sport is in the mind. Same applies to music, top-level music. It's in the mind.
Right, and this is being said in golf a lot too. Bernhard Langer, our best golfer ever, just said it recently, that it's 98% a mental game,
Yeah.
and that's oftentimes misunderstood, because as you write also, you need to acquire enough competence
Yes.
to be able to make it 98% mental. If you don't have the fundamentals, it doesn't matter if you have a strong mental game or if your head's in the right place, right?
I think first of all, you have to have the technical competence to be able to, in my case, control your instrument, or in the case of a golfer, control whatever club you're using. But then there's another level of it, which is an understanding of the tactics and the politics of what you're doing. So, for example, as a golfer, I'm given to understand that your choice of club is critical. And that part of the skill of the great golfers is their choice of club. For a musician, I have, over the half century I've been doing it, groped my way towards an understanding of music as a language of symbolic logic. And I have to manipulate that when I play. I'm working within a logic system, and you can tell when it goes wrong. I'm going to pick up an acoustic guitar. I'm going to give you an example.
Here we go.
Even people that say they are not musical can tell when I've gone wrong, even if I play a melody they don't know. If I go, you can tell when I break the chain of logic. So if I play a tune you do know, oh, let's try this one.
You got to hold the mic a little bit. We can't hear the music. There we go. Doesn't work. I don't know why. Can't hear.
Okay.
Can't hear it.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll sing it.
There you go. Johnny.
Da 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 da
There we go.
da 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 da. You know when I've gone wrong, don't you? Because I've broken the chain of logic. So when I'm playing in a musical ensemble,
Yes.
I have to be very careful not to lose my place in the logical system of what's going on. And when I'm improvising, and a lot of what I do is improvising, that's even harder because you're having to make up what you're playing as you go along. The closest analogy I can find is if you imagine you are playing Hamlet, a play, right? And you've got a very trendy young director who says, listen, you don't have to say the words that are written. When you get to the to be or not to be soliloquy, the director says, you don't have to say the words that Shakespeare wrote, but I want you to deliver the basic idea of the argument and the logic of the speech, but you can do it in your own words. And that's what improvising is about, is stay within the vocabulary of the piece.
But the improvisation is what makes it special, live music. I mean,
I totally, yes.
nothing's worse than an Eagles concert who play every song just the way it is on the record.
Partly because I think live music is probably the only performing, the only artistic activity in which the audience see the artwork being created. You know, if you're looking at a painting or reading a book, it has been honed in the privacy of the artist's studio and only released to the public when it's been perfected. Live music, you're there at the moment of its creation.
Is was Mike Oldfield when you went on this tour that when this project was developed, did he say, "Let me hear what you guys are doing there," or has he
No,
said so?
Robin Smith, who's the arranger, contacted him and said, "I've had this idea. I want to re for the Tubular Bells 50th anniversary. I want to reimagine it." If you imagine taking a picture and putting it in a new frame, he said, "That's kind of what I want to do." And his original idea was to have ballet dancers performing with it. That proved to be too expensive and not possible. So, by a string of bizarre actions, we ended up with a troupe of modern circus performers performing acrobatics at the festival hall, and it was frankly not entirely particularly well done. It was a bit intrusive.
But
But
you
Mike did give it his blessing. He said, "Yeah, Rob, this is a great idea. Do it."
are you're a sportsman yourself. You're an avid sailor
Yes.
and a amateur race car driver.
I wouldn't call myself an amateur race car driver. That's a rich man's sport if ever there was one. I
There you go.
love motorsport and I go to motorsport events regularly. I used to play a lot of tennis and
Will
thoroughly enjoyed it.
you tell us the story of how you on the Nürburgring when you went around the Nürburgring with I don't know what car you were driving?
A few years ago, the guy that I told you about, the tribute, the Vestenhagen Tribute Act, I did a gig for him. We had two gigs in a day. We had a lunchtime gig in a sort of Stadtfest in Düsseldorf. And then we drove down to Koblenz for a show for the Café Hahn in the Festung up there on the cliff.
Very nice.
And then I had to drive back up to Mönchengladbach the next day for a gig with Paddy Zimmerman in an Irish pub in Mönchengladbach. And we were driving. I said to my wife, "Okay, let's drive up the Moselle Valley rather than come back up the Rhine through Frankfurt. But let's drive up the Moselle Valley and drive across the Eifel Mountains." So she, yeah, great, okay. So we stopped and she bought a few bottles of wine and sampled some of the wine, which means that she was in no mood to object when saw us. And I said, "This is a bucket list thing. Would a German person know what a bucket list is?"
Absolutely, absolutely.
Good. Okay.
We're
So I
there.
said, "Right, this is a bucket list thing. You can drive your road car around the Nürburgring." So we drove to the Nürburgring and I paid my €29 and I drove around the Nürburgring, which I'd driven 100 times on the PlayStation
With the wife in the car?
with the wife in my Ford Mondeo. With a roof box on the top. And
Sounds like an Eddie Izzard story.
I said to myself, all the way round, I was going, "Do not be an idiot and wreck your car. Do not be an idiot and wreck your car." So I drove very sensibly.
Did you pass anybody?
No. We got lucky. There must have been a big accident behind us because suddenly there were no more cars passing us either. So I drove around the Nürburgring. I loved it. It was
In a
brilliant.
Ford Mondeo, cross
In a
that off
Ford
your
Mondeo 1.8 liter turbo diesel.
off your bucket list. I want to get back to these and folks, you should check out these blog articles. They're very compact, but they're full of stuff. And one of the things, and you said people get caught up in technique. And it's really the first time I've read it, and I've read about it for decades and everything. But you said Time to try hard is when you're first learning your instrument, whatever that is, whether it's a sports instrument or a musical instrument, whatever. Once you have acquired a skill level sufficient to achieve your ambitions. Many people just, and it goes back to what you said at the beginning, the striving, they just keep trying to get better and trying to get better and being really tense instead of thinking about, well, what are my ambitions? You know, I'm going to learn how to play the guitar. I can't sit around 6 hours a day and practice. So I'm going to limit myself to, I don't know, six chords, four chords. You can play a lot of songs with four chords and play those really well. Your ambitions obviously were to become one of the top session musicians, guitarists in the world. So you put in that work first.
Yes, but then in order to achieve that ambition of becoming a successful session musician, it became nothing to do with my technique or my instrument. It became everything to do with my ability to play the song, not the guitar. And I used to, when I was teaching, I used to tell my students, the first thing you should do if you're sitting down with an artist you've never worked with before and you don't know the material is ask for a lyric sheet to the songs that you're playing. Read the lyrics and then consider what you can do that is going to serve the song. You know, there's a if the song is about the death of a loved one, is it appropriate for me to go blah, 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 and play lots of fast stuff over it? Not really. My job now is to add my emotional experience of loss and pain to their loss and pain. Is the song a happy song about having a great time on the beach in the summer? Okay, then my job here is to add, and I used to give my students an exercise. I'd say, okay, you can play one note on your instrument, only one, and you can only play it once. Right, now play it for me with anger. Now play it for me with sadness. Now play it for me with joy. Now play it for me with love. And that's the job. And you learn. Session musicians that are successful because they play the song, not their instrument. They serve the song.
Do you still practice and do you still learn new things?
I play. I don't practice. I plug in my guitar and I just play.
So you've got the basics down and you go and play. And this is a valuable lesson for life. I mean, learn it and then go out and do it, right?
Learn it, then go out and do it. And the doing of it, you'll discover things as you do it. I get bored with what I play. Every 10 years, I get really bored with myself. So, you know, I start to explore new ideas. I'm learning the pedal steel guitar at the moment. I bought myself one for my 60th birthday, and only now have I got the time to sit and play
Right.
the hours I
Wonderful
need.
instrument.
It is. But you know, I pick up the guitar and I put up a blues backing track and I wail away on the guitar for an hour.
Yeah, there you go.
I
Are there
don't I don't I don't I don't have any firm practice routine. I just play.
Okay. Are there people you have turned down because you didn't like the music to play with it? Yes.
I had a call some years ago from an Irish friend of mine. He said,
Samantha Fox.
no. He said Van Morrison is looking for a guitar player with good backing vocals. Can I give him your number? And I said no, because he's known as being miserable, difficult, a bully, nasty, rude, arrogant, not a nice person. And I said no, because I know that I won't last a day with him.
Right.
Call him out, you know, if he's rude to me, I'll call him out on it and I'll be thrown out. So Let's just save all of us the pain of going through that. Thank you for thinking of me, but no, I don't want to know.
Yeah, he does seem like that kind of guy. But speaking of Van Morrison, they did this. I think one of his best performances was the last waltz the band did, the
Sure.
Thanksgiving. Today is Thanksgiving, where he was just amazing. Are there people that you wished you had gotten the chance to play with that you haven't gotten the chance to play with?
If any of the gods in whom I do not believe had come to me and said, "Jay, I'll take away your right arm tomorrow, but sorry, not tomorrow, I'll take away your right arm, but I will give you a year with the artist of your choice," I would have said David Bowie.
David Bowie.
I wish I'd played with David Bowie.
Wow. What a
Yeah, really, really, really.
what a cool ending to the show. Before you leave, you have given me I think one of the things I first asked you was, what do musicians listen to? And you introduced me to Gene Clark's No
Gene Clark's
Other,
No Other, yeah.
which is an unbelievable record. I mean,
It
I'd
is.
heard of the Birds before, and I love the Birds, but I'd never heard of this album before, and I still listen to it. Do you have a Gaheim tip for the listeners? What do you listen to?
Yeah, ask other people. I recently, on the Tubular Bells thing, I had to drive to a couple of the gigs, and I had the other guitar player and the guitar tech and one of the singers in the car with me. And we were playing, we were DJing off our phones on Spotify.
67 years old and DJing
And they're
the
like, they're in their 20s and they played me some music that opened me up. And I possibly played them some music that opened them up. Listen to what other people listen to and don't say, "Oh no, I don't like them." You don't know until you've heard it. And the other guitar player played me a couple of tracks by a band called The War on Drugs
Yeah, unbelievable.
that I loved.
Unbelievable.
I used to get it from my kids when my kids were at home. They would introduce me to new stuff, And I mean, we are the only profession in the world that doesn't listen to the radio while we're working.
Yeah, that's true. And the golfers are the only workers who take their wallet with to onto the pitch. Only the only athletes who take their wallet with them
Oh,
while they
there's an
play.
interesting thing.
Isn't
That's very
it? Well, there you
interesting.
go. I have way too much time on my hand. Well, I used to. Not anymore. Not anymore. What did the young kids turn you on to? War on Drugs, fabulous band. I think
Brilliant.
the guy, the guitarist, used to be with Kurt Weill. But when you look at the state of music, and it's all singers. I mean, it's that there's no bands really left anymore. Like
No.
when you and I were listening to this stuff, there were only bands.
Yes, they are out there. The problem is there is no pathway to getting heard for them anymore. Because radios like to play shiny, happy music by singers with nice haircuts. They're not that interested in a bunch of dirty kids.
Yeah, but those shiny singers, they need session musicians to and 50 dancers to do their live gigs.
So that's where the profession of the session musician still has some relevance. I refuse to become a bitter old muso whining in the pub about how the music business has all gone wrong. But I cannot escape the fact that pop music is no longer the most important thing in young people's lives. For our generation, pop music was our cultural identifier. What tribe did you belong to? Were you a Beatles fan? Were you a Stones fan? Were you a hippie or were you a skinhead? And it was the center of our culture. The other crucial thing about it was that your parents didn't like it.
Exactly. It was almost forbidden in a way to listen
Oh, in
to.
my case, that was not necessarily true. But nowadays, how can you rebel when your parents are also listening to, I don't know, Jay-Z, Snoop? I'm probably 10 years out of date already, but you know what I mean? What is there to rebel against?
There you
I
go.
don't know. There's a lot of what I learned when I was teaching at university. There are a lot of good singers and songwriters and artists out there, but they no longer have the traditional pathway to getting heard were DJs, and there would be DJs who you knew would play stuff that you liked. You knew they would also play stuff that you didn't think you liked, but would quite often end up liking. You trusted their taste. They were a kind of gatekeeper. Nowadays, DJs play a playlist that is determined by the marketing department of the station they work for,
There you
and they
go.
don't really have that much choice about what they play.
There you go. Do you still teach?
No, not in a formal way, no.
No, but do you still do the online teaching? Could
No,
somebody?
again,
No,
not.
no.
The only thing I do that is connected with education is that I occasionally do jobs for an organization that accredits university courses. We go to a university course, we go and see a university course, and we take a view on whether we think it's relevant to the real world industry,
Well,
which in an industry that is changing on a daily basis is challenging.
no, very noble. Your studio still running?
Yeah,
Drift,
but it's only for my stuff. I don't running a commercial studio is no chance because the revenue has gone out of sales of recorded music. Do you know how many plays on Spotify you have to earn £1,000?
I don't know. I'm guessing a million or more.
1.25 million.
Jesus. Yeah.
So,
£1,000.
the days when with Marius we used to spend 300,000 euros on making a record, you can't do that anymore. So the budget's not really in it. I use it for my own purposes and for people that I know and like. I get people saying, "Oh, Rob, I want to come in and sing over my backing tracks." And I go, "No, I don't do that. I'm not interested. I'm interested in working with creative people who are creating."
Well, I look forward to seeing you on the second leg of the Tubular Bells tour.
Well,
Very, very.
likewise, Frank, it'll be a pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're interested, you can find the dates and the tickets, Ticketmaster, wherever they can buy, you can get them. And I'm sure most of those shows are sold out that you just finished.
Yeah.
So get them while you can. Jay, it's been an absolute pleasure to hang with you for an hour. And it's always goes so quickly and so many things we didn't mention, but we'll talk
Indeed.
about it in March.
Frank, thank you for having me on your
Okay.
show and the best of luck with it. And
Thank you very much, Jay. Ladies and gentlemen, that was it. Das war's für heute. To the Linksland.